This is The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Faye Carruthers and welcome to The Guardian Women's Football Weekly. We come to you from Dublin in Ireland today ahead of the Lionesses' second Euro 2025 qualifier against the Republic, with news Leah Williamson retains the England captaincy and will start at the Aviva Stadium. We'll look back at all the opening games of the Euro 2025 qualifiers with teams back in action on Tuesday night, and we'll look at the state of play in a number of the domestic leagues around Europe, some competitive, some not. We'll discuss all that, plus we'll take your questions, and that's today's Guardian Women's Football Weekly. Women's Football Weekly is supported by Google Pixel, the only phone engineered by Google, an official mobile phone of Arsenal Football Club, Liverpool Football Club and the England teams. Google Pixel's working with the FA, Arsenal FC and Liverpool FC to close the visibility gap between men's and women's football with the formation of Pixel FC, a collective of next-generation creators and presenters dedicated to covering the women's game. They'll have exclusive access to players, additional resources and content creation opportunities to give women's football the visibility it deserves. Search Google Store to find out more. What a panel we have today. Susie Rack, it was a joy to spend time with you in Dublin.
Not a bad place to be.
It's all right, isn't it? Little tour guide as well going on. Might go on a bit of a jaunt today. And we've got two debutantes today. Let's start with Amy Rushkey from Goal. How are you doing?
I am good in this gloomy, wonderful day in the north of England. Can't wait to get out after this and walk the dog in the rain.
It's gloomy and wet and windy in Dublin as well. So you're in good company. But somebody who has to experience this all the time is Emma Duffy from the 42 here in Ireland. How are you?
Morning, guys. Nothing new here. Welcome to Dublin, though. Great to have you.
Yes, we got very damp yesterday. It was not pleasant, but it's a beautiful, beautiful city. I love the fact that we've got two debutantes for the pod today. Let's kick things off, shall we, and look back on what happened on Friday night in qualification for Euro 2025, where everything kicked off. Teams looking to book their spot in next summer's tournament, of course. Just to explain, the top two finishers from the four League A groups are going to join hosts Switzerland automatically into the tournament, and the remaining seven are going to have to qualify through a playoff system. So Group 3 in League A immediately caught the eye. France, England, Sweden and the Republic of Ireland were pulled out of that hat in the so-called Group of Death. I mean, it contains the world's second, third and sixth ranked teams in the world, and an up-and-coming Ireland team as well, who are looking to reach their second successive major tournament. But let's start at Wembley, shall we? Serena Wiegmann's Lionesses getting their campaign off to a bit of a stuttering start under the lights. They were held to a 1-1 draw by Sweden in the end. There's a lot of history between these two teams, but the last time they actually met, England were comfortable 4-0 winners at the semi-finals of the 2022 Euros that they eventually went on to win. And I think it's fair to say it wasn't a classic for the 63,000 people at Wembley, but the Lionesses, I'm sure, would be the most frustrated given it was on home soil and some of the mistakes that were made across the pitch, and they just struggled to create more than a handful of clear-cut chances while Sweden stretched and tested them. Alessia Russo's goal eventually cancelled out by Fridolina Rolfo. What did you make of the performance, Susie? What's going to be causing Serena Wiegmann and her staff sleepless nights at the moment?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I don't think England were awful. I just think Sweden were very, very good defensively, well organised, had a plan for sort of targeting Ciara Walsh and targeting Alex Greenwood and cutting off the supply to the forward line. And it worked really, really well. In some ways, I'm sort of like unworried because I don't think England look terrible. In other ways, it sort of slightly harks back to the Nations League campaign where they missed out on the playoffs on getting a chance to take Team GB to the Olympics, because there was just like a lack of that was right up top in that tournament, particularly early on. So with such a competitive group, there's not really any room for like a lead-in or, you know, a little stumble here and there. So they sort of need to find their shooting boots fast, and I'm not totally convinced that that is necessarily going to happen, which is slightly concerning.
Yeah. I mean, Wiegmann called Sweden's equaliser completely unnecessary as England's defence switched off and Lucy Bronze allowed Rolfa to surge in unmarked at the back post, heading home Rosa Kafahi's cross. The Lionesses have managed just two clean sheets in the last 12 games, which is a worry in itself, Amy.
Yeah, I think it's somewhat understandable when you consider Millie Bright's been out for quite a while and was in and out before that. Lee Williamson's obviously not played for England for a year. And I think we've done to death the lack of sort of full-back, at left-back at least. And then you look at Lucy Bronze on the right and she's not really got much competition for that player, she'd say. So I think there are quite a few sort of individual problems across the back line. And, you know, some of them are solvable and some of them are sort of less so. So I think it goes a bit back to what Susie was saying there. You need to sort of get your shooting boots on when you know that you can't just keep teams out and win 1-0. You need to score two. You need to score three. You need to score possibly four to win the game. And they need to sort of build on that as well as looking to solve some of those issues at the back.
Yeah. I mean, look, we've got to give massive credit to Sweden as well, because they were really aggressive in their press. They bypassed England's midfield on numerous occasions, and they could and should have won it as well. But Stina Blackstenius just fluffed completely that one-on-one opportunity that she had. Their coach, Peter Gerhardsen, said post-match that the number one plan was to take away Kira Walsh. I mean, we've heard this before, haven't we? And Emery arguably got his game plan spot on. What was so effective about their strategy?
Yeah, I definitely think, I suppose, targeting Kira Walsh, they got great joy out of that. And it's certainly a blueprint that Ireland can look to ahead of their big game. And then just as well, they were really effective on the counter-attack. Like, you know, it's all well and good sitting deep and then trying to break, but without substance behind it, it's not really going anywhere. And that's probably something that Ireland have certainly struggled with. And Sweden showed them the way the other night. Like, you know, they have some really big hitters. You mentioned Blackstenius, Rolfo, those type of players who are generally clinical. Obviously, that was a pretty disappointing miss from Blackstenius and a real let off for England because they tore them apart in that instance. And it wasn't just there and then, like, there were other examples too. But I do think on the balance of things, 1-1 was probably a fair enough result. But definitely there's learnings that Ireland can take from how Sweden set up and how they approach the game.
Yeah, we're gonna look in depth at the Ireland game in part two. But the spark in England's performance, Susie, was arguably Alessia Russo. It was her third goal in three games. And Serena Wiegmann was particularly pleased when I spoke to her yesterday with her movement. But where does this performance leave England overall, would you say?
It's a good question. I mean, yeah, I think Alessia Russo is obviously starting to find her shooting boots on a little bit more of a regular occasion for England. I do think England needs someone who's going to stay between the width of the post to a certain extent, like a bit of an Ellen White type figure that they don't have. And I don't think that necessarily means that has to be Alessia Russo or she has to be dropped for someone that is going to do that. But I think they need to have that option within their ranks, which they don't really have. They're struggling. You know, when they bring her off, it's often shifting Hemp into the middle and she's not a target player. And that, I don't think, is necessarily the solution. And again, Sweden, they're sort of reliant on trying to break through the back line and get the ball into the feet, use the pace of Hemp to break the back line. And it just didn't quite work for them. And I think they just need a few more options up top and that would solve some problems. But it's not Alessia Russo's fault that she's not necessarily that player, because she's a different player, holds up the ball so well and stuff. So I'm not really sure what the answer is, but I don't think they've quite worked out how they replace, even now, a year on, someone like Ellen White, who is, you know, an out-and-out goal scorer, will stick between the width of the post and, you know, will break records in the process.
It was really interesting, actually, because I posed this question to Serena Wiegmann yesterday and she got a bit defensive about it and protected her players and said actually she's really pleased with what the front line are doing, and she's pleased with the work that Alessia Russo has been doing additionally. So maybe it's just us that have to adapt the way we see, you know, a target player up front, and that the game is evolving, and she's actually playing the players who are best suited to the game that they're playing now, maybe.
If it starts delivering results, then maybe.
Yeah, look, the whole point of this new format as well was to play the toughest opposition. So we always knew that this was going to be a really stern test. And it looks, as we expected, that this group's going to be really tight and competitive as well. Got this question from Sue, who got in touch with us on X. Really like this format for the qualifiers. 15 of 16 teams from League A could progress, but allows for any improving in B and C to join the party, and also results in competitive fixtures. What do you all think? Who wants to take this? Amy?
I love the format. I've been a fan of the format since they announced it. I know that it was quite sort of convoluted. So when you look at it head on, when they announced it, everyone was like, how on earth does this work? But I think it's actually a lot less complicated than it looks on paper in motion. There are some flaws to it. Obviously, the scheduling is a big sort of talking point at the moment. And with the volume of games at the Nations League and then the qualifiers present, that's going to be a sort of problem. And hopefully UEFA can sort of look at that and address it and make it less demanding on the fixture schedule. But I think even when I've spoken to sort of smaller teams, I spoke to when they announced the format, people in Malta, people in Albania, like people in Luxembourg, and they were like, we love this format because it allows them to develop at their own pace rather than chucking them in to lose 20-0, you know, every few days with players that can't even get the day off work to travel to England or Sweden or something. I think it's great. I think, you know, it does restrict possibly the embedding of young players a little bit, maybe. You know, you don't have as many friendlies or games against sort of really low-ranked teams, but you do also get that chance to put those young players into really meaningful games and you get to bed them in. And, I mean, look at how competitive it is. Look at, you get to get these top teams come against each other every few days. Like, I think it's great. I think it's exactly what the game needed after all, you know, the 20-0s. I remember that international break when England beat Latvia 20-0 and you had like an 18-0, a 19-0. I think it's a really good first answer to a problem, and I think it'll develop over time as well.
Yeah, what do you make of it, Emma, as a Republic of Ireland fan? Because obviously, you know, everybody is expecting you to finish bottom of the league, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I'd echo some of Amy's thoughts there. The scheduling definitely needs to be looked at, but I suppose this is probably a bit of an anomaly of a year, just an Olympic year as well, so it is quite front-loaded. Yeah, the draw, I think, could be done a little bit better. I feel like Ireland are really hard done by there, but such is life. You know, they want to be among the best teams in Europe, among the best teams in the world, and how else to get there than to play against them. It's actually quite interesting. I know that former Ireland manager Vera Pauw wasn't a fan whatsoever of this new system. You know, she spoke about how, you know, teams in kind of the middle tier, aka Ireland at the time, may be forgotten about, whereas the focus is on the top tier teams and then the developing lower ranked teams, as Amy said, that, you know, are trying to develop at their own pace. A lot of it comes back to funding as well. But I do think, like you say, you're getting competitive games. You just hope that the fourth seed teams can compete. And we saw Ireland did on opening night. It's not going to get any easier whatsoever, but it's definitely an interesting system. And it just means loads of top level games against top level opposition and hopefully narrow scorelines as well. You don't want those 20-0s, those 18-0s, because, you know, that is just so difficult on the teams that have to gear up to face that. So yeah, I suppose we'll play it by ear, see how it goes. But so far, so good.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you kept it to a low scoreline against France, who are ranked third in the world, didn't you? And, you know, they earned a narrow win over Republic of Ireland on Friday night, finished France 1, Republic of Ireland 0. Eileen Gleeson's side are the underdogs in the group. I think it's fair and not patronising to say, but they seem to kind of thrive on that, it feels. And bar that 6-minute goal from Marie-Antoinette Katoto, they managed to keep the waves of French attack at bay on Friday. They also could have equalised in the 87th minute to bring a point back to Dublin. But what stood out for you, Emma, from this Irish performance?
Yeah, I think it went as expected, Faye. Like, Ireland were obviously always going to set up really defensively. They were going to revert to a 5-4-1. And, you know, it was all about sitting deep and trying to catch France on the break. Now, when that goal went in the 6th minute, I was going, oh God, this could be pretty bad. The hope was to hold it 0-0 for as long as possible, possibly grind out a scoreless draw or, you know, seize an absolutely famous result at the death somehow, some way. But it was always going to be a taller order once France scored earlier. But I think Ireland responded well, to be fair. I think, you know, they got on with it. And like you say, France did have a fair few attempts. I think it was 21 shots as opposed to Ireland's one. And that wasn't even that chance at the end that you referred to. That was, I think, a Caitlin Hayes flick on from a header, which just happened to go on target. But yeah, that was a... I wouldn't say an opportunity at the end. It was certainly an opening. And Leanne Kiernan unfortunately took the wrong decision. Katie McKay was absolutely screaming for it, unmarked in the box. So I suppose Ireland do need to seize those chances. They're not going to come around very often if they play this way, but they do have to take them when they come. So I suppose it's a little bit of mixed emotions. There's definitely positives to take from it because a lot of people would have expected a much bigger scoreline. But then there are little frustrating things like that as well, that these chances or opportunities don't come around too often. You have to take them, and they'll certainly have to take them now against England if and when they do arise.
I think what's really interesting is, you know, even if they do finish bottom of the group, like the going into the playoffs, the amount of experience at playing top level side this takes into the playoffs is the more interesting thing for me. Like, sort of regardless of how well they do in this group, which I actually think they could cause a fair few problems, that playoff situation is what is really exciting for me. Because, I mean, like, so few teams in that tournament post this group stage are going to have had this level of teams that they've played at this level of the game. So that's where this tournament sort of really comes into its own for Ireland for me, and where it gets really exciting, which I'm...
Yeah, I agree. And, it, you know, you mentioned the chances there as well. But Everton's Courtney Brosnan was well up for the task, wasn't she? She produced another really inspired performance in goal to keep the deficit to just one. Is she maybe one of the more underrated goalkeepers in the WSL, Amy, for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think I've put her in my team of the season so far at Christmas, actually. She's one of those goalkeepers that can just come up with those really, really big moments. And I think that's so big for Everton and Ireland as well, to have a goalkeeper that, you know, can sort of stand up against really top teams, you know, when her team can be under pressure like they were against France and like Everton, you know, often are when they come up against the big teams in the WSL, and just produce something that, you know, not just keeps the team in the game, but sort of gives your team a little bit of belief as well. Like, you know, look at the saves our goalkeeper can make, you know, have that confidence in the goalkeeper behind you. Yeah, I think she's a real top-class goalkeeper. I really do.
Yeah, she has been incredible, hasn't she? You'll kind of remember France suffered disappointment in February. It was a really underwhelming performance in the Nations League final. They qualified as hosts for the Olympics anyway, but they kind of don't really seem to be firing on all cylinders, which they haven't done for a while. And manager Hervé Renard is constantly linked with other jobs, which is not particularly helpful either as they head into a home Olympics. But what do you make of them overall, Susie?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because that Nations League final, I mean, like, it's Spain, right? They are just cut above everyone else, world champions. So, you know, a loss to them in a Nations League final is not, like, you know, anything to be sniffed at, really. And their record before that is actually pretty decent. You know, the last game they lost before that was the quarterfinal in Australia, which was on penalties after a 0-0 draw at the end of extra time. And before that, their only sort of normal time loss was a loss to Australia in a friendly back in July last year. So, like, in terms of consistency, they've actually been not too bad. I mean, they've not played, like, the best teams in the world. Germany in the Nations League semi-final, 2-1 win, though, you know, you could say Germany here and not necessarily a top team at the moment either. But, like, they have got a degree of consistency there, even if they've not sort of been set in the world alight. So they're sort of perennial underachievers, right? Like, for the talent at their disposal, it never seems to quite click at the right times for them. But they are consistently getting results at the moment, bar that Nations League final. But like, I think they are a threat in this group to a greater extent than maybe some people give them credit for.
Yeah, elsewhere in Ligue 1, Italy recorded a surprise victory over the Netherlands, while Germany came back from 2-2 to win against Austria 3-2. World champion Spain, meanwhile, beat Belgium 7-0. Are we all just thinking that the Euros is written for Spain? I hope it becomes more competitive than that. In Ligue B, disappointment for Scotland and Northern Ireland, who both played out goalless draws. Wales, though, got off to a perfect start under their new manager, Rianne Wilkinson, with a 4-0 win over Croatia in Wrexham. And Jess Fishlock starred in this one with a brace and an assist that puts her now within 2 of Helen Ward's all-time goal-scoring record. She's 37 now, and she's going to reach her 150th cap if she plays against Kosovo on Tuesday night, but has said this is going to be her last qualification campaign. This is what Lawrence on X said. Jess Fishlock, 150 caps tomorrow. Amazing, isn't she? I mean, Susie, is there anyone that epitomises Welsh football more than her? And how much are they going to miss her when she calls time in her career?
No, like, so no one does. She's so talismanic for that Wales team. She's irreplaceable. Not just, like, obviously footballing ability. She's, like, supremely talented, right? But also just personality and, like, yeah, what she brings to that team in terms of, like, identity and as a focal point, I think is unrivaled. I mean, I suppose you could say if you compare to Kim Little at Scotland, like, that level of impact, but I would say even greater. You know, you're talking about someone who has been a figurehead and has driven that team from the front for such a long, long time. Utterly irreplaceable, and I don't know what the team looks like without her. Like, I just can't picture Wales without this Fishlock. You know, they've got a lot of talent coming through, but you know, the fact that at 37 she is still the star of that team speaks to just how influential she is and how much they've got to do to bring through some of those players to sort of plug this huge gaping hole she's going to leave. It'd be great if she breaks that goal scoring record, because I mean, she deserves it, obviously. You know, it's Helen Ward's goal scoring record, and you know, another brilliant, like, legend of Welsh women's football. But yeah, it would be nice to see Fishlock walk away with 150 caps plus and that goal scoring record.
Yeah, it feels as if they're entering into a new era as well, because they're going to have to find a new captain. Because Sophie Ingall's stepping down from the captaincy after 9 years. She will continue to play, but this is what she had to say. I think it's the right time for me, for the team moving forward, that I pass on the captain's armband. It's probably made me the character that I am today, because when I first received it at the age of 23, I was a shy young girl who didn't really speak to the team. That really gave me the power to have to speak to the girls and develop those relationships. We've done that for many years now. I mean, what an innings she's had. But as I say, a bit of a revolution going on in Wales at the moment. Right, that's it for part one. In part two, we're going to look ahead to the huge game in Dublin between Republic of Ireland and England. And we're going to take a look at the state of play in some of the European leagues ahead of the home stretch. Welcome back to part two of the Guardian Women's Football Weekly. Right, let's look ahead to the game between Republic of Ireland and England at the Aviva Stadium on Tuesday night. Full disclosure, we are recording this in Dublin on Tuesday morning. Very much looking forward to this one. It's a historic fixture as well, but they haven't actually faced each other competitively since 1987. Over 30,000 tickets have been sold so far. Emma, how are you feeling ahead of this one? There must be quite a lot of emotion involved around how far Ireland have progressed to get to this point where they're hosting these kind of occasions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been incredible covering this team the last few years in particular. I suppose the World Cup last summer was obviously so, so special, and qualification for that and that night in Hampden Park when Amber Barrett scored the goal that sent us to our first ever major tournament. But now to be playing regularly in the Aviva Stadium and to be getting massive crowds, like you say, over 30,000, it's incredible to see. It really is massive occasion, but just another game, as Katie McCabe and Eileen Gleeson are saying, it's just another step along the journey. They're really trying to downplay this, but you know, there's no hiding from the fact that England are obviously European champions, World Cup finalists, second in the world. Ireland are 26th in the world. There's obviously a huge difference between the teams, but Ireland have certainly been punching above their weight in the last while, and they'll hope to continue to do so on their journey as they keep developing, hopefully into one of the top nations.
No one falls for the mind games anymore. I don't know why footballers and managers try and do that in this day and age. None of us are getting it. Listen, Amy, we know that Ireland are going to set up pretty strong defensively, most likely with five at the back. But I mean, England's lack of creativity against Sweden might have been a bit of a warning sign. What are they going to need to improve on to break this Ireland team down?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the main thing I was thinking about going into this game as well. I think they've sort of lacked that spark in the sort of number 10 role for quite a while now. If you think about the Nations League performances, you know, Frank Kirby was pretty good in that 6-0 over Scotland. But other than that, I don't think anybody who played in that attacking midfield role really lit up a game. So I think that's a real challenge. And I mean, Sabina Biegman's got, what, 4, maybe 5 options to play there. So maybe choosing the right one to suit this game and to suit the players around her is quite an important sort of selection in that team. I was quite surprised on Friday to see Lauren Hemp and Lauren James start on the wings that they did. It's not often that you see Lauren Hemp spend much time on the right, really. You know, it forces her to sort of cut inside onto a left to shoot, where Hashemp is probably running to the byline and getting a cross in. And you saw it was literally, what, 2 minutes after they swapped that Lauren James, you know, was in a little dribble and puts the ball in that Alessia Russo heads home. So I think it's just those little fine details of just getting the team selection right, getting the combinations right in attack, because it's going to be really difficult. We saw Ireland at the World Cup last year. They put up a real fight and they were a real tough test, but everybody in a really tough group, you know, it's not just that they were great on Friday, they've been great for a while. So yeah, England are going to have their work cut out, definitely, I think.
They're going to have to be improved defensively as well themselves. But Leah Williamson joining Sarina Wiegmann in the press conference yesterday kind of, you know, alludes, well, it doesn't allude, Sarina Wiegmann confirmed it. Leah is starting, which is brilliant. And she's starting as captain as well, which she told me yesterday she felt was a real show of faith from Sarina Wiegmann. She was really delighted with after having a year out. But how important for the Lionesses is it going to be to have her back, and what's she going to add to the game?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on her in a sense as well. I mean, you know, she's not, like, she's been good coming back for Arsenal, but there's not been like completely perfect performances across the board. You know, she's had games where she struggled, the Chelsea defeat in the league, like, I think is one of those. So, you know, it's not a given that she's going to come in with the, you know, the exact same ability and vision we sort of see from her, like, time in, time out before her injury for England. So it's going to be interesting to see exactly what that looks like. But having her and, you presume, Alex Greenwood playing at centre-back is just, like, such a solid pairing. Alex Greenwood, arguably the most informed English centre-back at the moment. And then Leah's got that vision, bringing the ball out from the back, that, like, is irreplaceable, really. I feel quite sorry for Lotta Obomoi, who has been exceptional for Arsenal so far this season, finally gets her trial for England, and then Leah is sort of back coming into fitness. It's like the timing of that is not amazing for her. You know, England didn't look defensively infallible against Sweden, quite shaky when they broke, and that's what you're going to see Ireland trying to do. So it's logical to bring in someone who's going to shore that up a little bit more. That said, you know, that was Lotta's like first start in a competitive fixture for England in God knows how long. So, like, it's not totally fair to say that she wouldn't have settled a little bit more into that role as well. So, yeah, it's hugely important for the sort of vision she had playing out from the back. But, like, England have options at centre-back now, which is really exciting. Like, good options. And it's not a given that she necessarily walks into the squad, which is also quite exciting.
I did ask Sarina Wiegmann if it was going to be a change in a formation or just in personnel. And she said just in personnel. So they'll stick with the four at the back. But I did wonder whether Alex Greenwood could return to left back as an option for them and see Lotta and Leah together. But as you say, she's in such fantastic form as centre back for Manchester City, that would kind of almost be a bit of a travesty at the same time. But I wonder whether she might do a little bit of a rejig depending on how the game is going. But from an Ireland perspective, Emma, I mean, that match against France was Eileen Gleeson's first competitive match since she was named permanent manager. She obviously did oversee the successful Nations League campaign in the autumn. But there were three new competitive debutantes in Anna Patton, Emily Murphy and Jessie Stapleton. What have you made of her time in charge so far and the new additions to the team so far? And also, what exactly do we need to look out for in terms of how they can threaten England?
I suppose in terms of Gleeson, she obviously came in for the Nations League, as you said. Not everyone thought that she would be made permanent manager, and she kind of brushed it away herself every time she was asked. She basically reeled herself out of the running. So to some, it was a big surprise when she was named permanent manager before Christmas, but then picked up where she left off. Obviously, a 100% record through the Nations League, two friendlies in February, a 0-0 draw with Italy, and then a 2-0 defeat to Wales, which was disappointing. Like, Ireland weren't great that night. They did change formation. They tried to play four at the back. One of Gleeson's big mantras is adaptability and being able to adapt to games and change things. So Ireland had played five at the back for so long, as everyone knows, or the three with the two wing backs, so three or five. They played the four against Italy, did quite well, but then it all kind of fell asunder against Wales and they've reverted to their five. But as you say, she's blooded new players. Caitlin Hayes has been a huge addition. She came straight into the team and hasn't left it since. Has really, really impressed the centre half. Same as Anna Patton the other night. That was a surprise to me, I'm not going to lie. I didn't realise that was going on in the background. But obviously from watching her in the WSL and seeing her against France the other night, looks a really good addition as well. And, you know, so composed on the ball, can offer those, I suppose, passing from deep, means a break in the lines as well. So she's another big recruit. And then, as you say, Jessie Stapleton. Jessie is one of the brightest young talents in Irish football, really versatile player, can play centre half, midfield, can nearly put her anywhere. But Stapleton actually was in training with Ireland in a home-based training session at the age of 13. So her star has been marked from that young age, and, you know, she has carried that weight of expectation exceptionally, and I think she's going to be a huge player for Ireland going forward. But yeah, definitely there's been a focus on, I suppose, building more depth in the squad, that's for sure. Like, even when you look at the comparisons between the England squad and the Ireland squad, all but three of England's players, I think, play in the WSL, and that's Lucy Bronze and Ciara Walsh at Barcelona and Georgia Stanway at Bayern Munich. And then you look at the Ireland squad, the vast majority play in the Championship. And then it's other leagues around Europe, the US, Ireland, and then the WSL. So that's definitely a gulf, and that has been flagged, and it's, I suppose, being worked on. And the thing just with the Irish league as well, just as an aside, I suppose there's lots of young talent in the Irish league, but it's just not at the level of England just yet. But you'd hope that will, you know, the work that's going on there at grassroots level will pay dividends down the line. And then your other question, Faye, was just about how you think Ireland can get at England, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Basically, I think, yeah, their best bet is on the counter again. That's no secret. I was quite disappointed the other night that they didn't seem to have a plan. And look, it's easier said than done. Like, you're playing against immensely high pressure in France and in England and in Sweden, and you only have a second on the ball. Like, they're straight on you. So it's easier said than done, but I do think they need to show a little bit more going forward. They do need to be a little bit braver. Like, yes, they're going to sit deep, but they really do need to take those openings if they do arise. And, you know, like, Ciara Crews up top was chasing shadows the other night, but she's more so a hold up player, so when she gets the ball, it needs to stick and they need to go from her. There's no point trying to play her in behind. Like, if you want, it's a different type of player you need if that's the plan. So I think in terms of team selection, it'll be similar, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a few changes. Wouldn't be surprised to see Katie McCabe back at left wing back, the likes of Izzy Atkinson maybe coming in, and I think the midfield will be freshened up. I could see Rita Littlejohn starting tonight, and then potentially someone else to play off Keira Caruso, maybe Lucy Quinn, Leanne Kiernan, someone like that.
Well, it's going to be fascinating, isn't it? And I really hope that all of you are listening to this on Tuesday so that this is completely relevant. Otherwise, you're just going to be going, what a load of rubbish, none of that happened. So I'm not even going to ask you for your predictions, just in case you're all listening on Wednesday. But with the final part of the season ahead, we thought we'd take a look at how things stand in some of the leagues across Europe while we're in this European qualifying stage. We actually get a little bit of time to go around and see what's going on. We'll start in Spain, where Barcelona currently lead Real Madrid by 12 points at the top of the table. It looks very much like manager Jonathan Giraldez is going to leave his time at Barca with a third Liga F title. We will, of course, be talking about Barcelona properly in the coming weeks in terms of Champions League. But once again, Real Madrid fall away, Susie. I mean, there's rumours of multiple departures on the horizon, with Colombia's Linda Caicedo linked with Lyon, Hayley Raso on the way out as well. Why is it that they're struggling to close that gap?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of the impossible task, isn't it? In that, like, Barcelona are a developed side with a developed youth system and a style of playing football that keeps them at the top. And are so dominant that you're basically reliant on players, top level players, coming in and accepting that they're not going to win anything and are going to be second best for like seasons and seasons and seasons, and you need to retain them in order to develop and to add to them. But you're basically you're going into Real Madrid knowing that you're going to be second, so like that's really difficult, right? Like if a player is ambitious and a big club from another league like a Lyon come in who are, you know, perennial winners, you want trophies. So that's a really difficult position to be in. You know, I think you could look at, say, league positions since Real Madrid came in as a team and say, oh, well, the gap is closing. 25 points first season, 30-point gap second season between them and Barcelona top. 10 in the third season, currently a 12-point gap. Oh, it's getting smaller. You could argue that, but that, like, I mean, yes, they're improving season on season, but they're not beating Barcelona. They've yet to beat them. So, like, it's a really, really difficult situation to be in because you're chasing the best team in Europe, possibly in the world, who are still developing, who can attract any player they want in the world. Yeah, Real Madrid's recruitment is on the basis of, you know, for a good while, you are going to be joining a team that is going to be second. So keeping hold of those players is really difficult. But I think that is, like, that's the big problem, is Barcelona are such a mature team developmentally, and then with this absolutely brilliant, like, youth structure below it as well. Like, it's a really established and developed team, and closing that gap on a team of that nature is like not a 1-year project, not a 5-year project. It is like a 10-year project, which, you know, players aren't necessarily going to stick around for.
It feels very similar in Germany as well, Amy, to be honest. Bayern Munich enjoying an equally comfortable lead at the top of the Frauen Bundesliga, looking to lift successive titles. It was a comfortable 4-0 victory for Georgia Stanway's side, seeing Wolfsburg's title hopes fade dramatically. And it's always been a bit of a ding-dong between these two sides, but it almost feels a bit as if Wolfsburg are falling away too. What is the reason for that? What's been the key to Bayern's success this season?
Yeah, I think we're kind of seeing, I mean, time will tell, but it's almost like a changing of the guard there. I know Bayern have been targeting being the number one team in Germany for a while now, and it's been about building up because Wolfsburg have had that status for such a long time. And, you know, you look at Lena Obidorf's going to leave Wolfsburg this summer and join Bayern Munich, and I think that's quite symbolic in the way that German women's football's kind of going. I think for Bayern this season, it's been a little bit last season, like they're, I think this is, what's the old saying, you know, defences win championships, right? And their defence has been massive. I mean, they do not concede chances, never mind goals. You know, they fewest shots against in the league, fewest goals conceded. You know, the XG against them is the smallest in the league, and they've actually got the most positive difference between the XG they've conceded and the goals they've actually conceded as well. Like, they're just do not concede goals. They're so hard to beat. And then you look at the other end of the pitch, you look at some of the players in their squad, you know, Clara Boole and Pernilla Harder and Leah Schuller and Georgia Stanway and these kind of players that will, you know, while you're to nil, they'll go down the other end and win the game. So I think we have to mention how well they've played in those two games against Wolfsburg as well, because the gap to them is 7 points and they beat Wolfsburg home and away, and that's 6 points of that gap. So to turn up in these games, you know, we know it in the WSL how big those games between the top teams are, and you know, Bayern have absolutely shown up in those two games to give themselves quite a comfortable lead to put themselves in position to win the title.
Yeah, and Wolfsburg's kind of equivalents in France were always Lyon, and actually they're still continuing their domination of French football, Emma, aren't they? Hunting down their 17th Division 1 title, which is quite incredible. I mean, it would be the perfect farewell for Sonia Bombastor, wouldn't it? But as it's been reported, she's leaving for Chelsea in the summer. But I mean, at some point, someone else has got to step up, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose no more than at Chelsea, where Bombastor is reportedly, as you say, coming in. Speculation has certainly been shut down by Chelsea. But, you know, it's obviously a huge job at both clubs. Like you say, 17 league titles in 18 years they're closing in on. That's just unbelievable. Three in a row. I suppose even I was just looking back at Van Bastor's record, and it's 110 games played, 94 won, 10 drawn, 6 lost, which is incredible. A win rate of 85%. And then obviously you throw in that 2022 Champions League title. It hasn't been half bad. It would be the perfect send-off. They're obviously still in Champions League contention as well. And Chelsea on the other side of that draw. So it's going to be an interesting few weeks for sure. But just in terms of the season overall, their domestic season, they're looking to go unbeaten. It's 18 wins and one draw. They play PSG later this month. So that's obviously going to be a big one. But it's looking like it's going that way, and that Bombastor will be leaving on a high note should she be departing. We'll obviously find out more over the next few weeks, but just credit to what she has done at Lyon, both as a player and as manager, but definitely, as you say, big, big shoes to fill for whoever may come in there.
Oh, I mean, wouldn't it be incredible if it's Emma Hayes versus Sonia Bombastor for the Champions League final, and both want to end their, you know, careers at incredible clubs on a high? That would be something else, wouldn't it? They've got to get there first. Let's look at Italy's Serie A. It's another league that seems to be pretty wrapped up already. AS Roma leading Juventus by 10 points with 6 games to go, which would be back-to-back titles for Alessandro Spugna's side. What have you made of their journey to success, Susie?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, like, you know, chatting about Real Madrid earlier, like, you know, Roma equally a team relatively in their infancy, but able to, like, have a real impact on a league pretty quickly. And I think that speaks to, like, the league as a whole and the fact that it's been a little bit behind developmentally. So, you know, an investment, a clear ideology to the way they play, really, really shrewd recruitment that fits the philosophy of the manager, has enabled them to, like, have an impact that is making them be able to retain players and to go on a charge and to have the ambition of actually winning things in a way that Real Madrid can't, for example. So that it's sort of like a bit of a different scenario, you know, because the real sort of investment in Italy has come from Juventus and Fiorentina, sort of Juventus more recently, Fiorentina a little bit more historically. But that level has been pretty low. So coming in and making an impact and shaking things up and becoming the dominant team is a far easier job in Italy than it is in, say, France, where Lyon are the developed team, or in England, where you've got a few, particularly Chelsea at the top, or Spain, where you've got Barcelona. So that for me is really exciting. But it's not just that they've come in and brought in a load of, like, really, really, like, top superstar players. They've brought in players that really fit the system, and it's made them a really, really exciting team. I think it's no accident that, you know, first season in Champions League, they reached the quarterfinals. Like, obviously, this season, Champions League, not the best exit from the group stage, bottom of the group. But, like, when you're in a league with, like, a group stage with Bayern Munich, Ajax and Paris, I mean, that's sort of to be expected to a certain extent, and speaks to the fact that the Italian league is you know, developmentally a step behind the top European nations. But in terms of like philosophy and talent and like just being enjoyable to watch, Roma are doing a really, really, really good job.
Let's go to Scotland, shall we? And this is what we want. A competitive league, a title race. Yes, please. The Scottish Women's Premier League serving up the most drama this season. Rangers currently leading Celtic by 1 point, with current champions Glasgow City just 3 points behind the latter in third. So will Joe Potter's side be able to lift the second domestic title, Amy?
I mean, I hope we get another end of the season like last year. They call it Helicopter Sunday, was it, where it was like three teams in the race for it. I love a final day like that. And I think this season as well, none of them play each other on the final day. So it'd be three games to keep across and the kind of permutations of like hopping around. So I hope it stays this close till the final day. As for Rangers, I think, you know, that League Cup win the other week could be a real boost to them. You know, they lost to Celtic just the week before, and then about, you know, a week later, you're lifting the trophy. So that must give you a real confidence boost as you move into the last stages of the title race. But I think, you know, there's, what, eight really big games left. And I think it's kind of the beauty of this split format that Scotland has had kind of historically across men's football at least. But yeah, I think it kind of being, as that split makes it so much more intensified and amplified each game. You know, there's no sort of like, oh, well, they'll easily beat that team. It's so amplified, and yeah, it's going to be a really, really good running.
Yeah, it certainly is. Finally, a quick word on the League of Ireland, given that we have Emma on today. It would be remiss of us not to ask. Look, the season's only been underway for a few weeks, but how are things shaping up early on? How important is this flourishing domestic league for the future of the international side as well?
Yeah, hugely important. It's been quite stop-start so far this season, obviously with the international break and the All-Ireland Cup around the games there too. But Galway United are currently top with 3 wins from 3. Pimaint are second, the reigning champions, and Shelburne are third. So Pimaint won last year. There was a lot of changes in the off-season, I suppose, with the league moving to a semi-professional capacity. Pimaint are not affiliated with a men's team, so it was a massive, massive achievement to see them go and win the league. You know, a lot had been made of their underdog status. They will say they were written off. I'm not sure they were entirely, because the last few seasons it has been Pimaint, Shelburne and Wexford in the mix towards the end. But that's not taken away from their achievement. It was absolutely incredible what they did last year. They've obviously started with a little bit of a mixed bag this year, but Galway United are looking very, very good. They've quite a good young team, a nice smattering of experience there as well, but lots of really talented young internationals, underage Irish internationals. So they've made a strong start, and there seems to be real belief there with what they're doing. So it's going to be interesting to see how the next few weeks pan out. But like Amy was saying there a few seasons in a row, we had it go down to the wire, right down to the final day, and it was so exciting. Last year was settled a little bit earlier than that, but I wouldn't mind seeing it go all the way this year again.
Yeah, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? I love just hearing about how the leagues have gone around Europe this year, because we don't get to focus on it too much on the show because the WSL is so competitive, and you know, it shows how lucky we are in England really to have such a competitive league. But we'll keep doing these updates because I think it's really interesting going forward. And this is slightly left field because we've been talking about European teams, but we must mention players coming towards the end of their careers. We were just talking earlier on about Jess Fishlock and Sophie Ingall, but outside of Europe, New Zealand are bidding farewell to a legend, Rhea Percival announcing that she's hanging up her international boots. She's obviously been part of the firm's setup for the last 18 years, 166 caps that she's amassed, which is the most of any New Zealand player, male or female. She's appeared in 5 World Cups, 4 Olympic Games. I mean, I don't even know how you even begin to summarise the impact she's had on the game in her country, Amy.
Nah, remarkable servant. I think any of us that flew to Australia to do the World Cup last summer, probably our eyes opened to how demanding it must be to be a regular international of Australia or of New Zealand and to play in Europe for her to have an 18-year career and to spend, you know, I think the last 12 or so years in Europe, in Germany, in Switzerland, and now in England, she, you know, she's flying 24 hours to New Zealand every time she's flying to represent the country back home. And, you know, for things like qualifiers in OFC and stuff, all the way there, all the way back for that long. I mean, it's remarkable. And to continue to deliver your best and to lead your team, you know, she's been one of the figureheads for the progress that they've made in that time. Like, yeah, I think it's just, yeah, a remarkable achievement. And she's had some fantastic memories to take with her. I spoke to her a couple of years ago, and, you know, she was playing in front of 50,000 at 17 in a World Cup in China. You know, she was part of that New Zealand team that got out of the group stages in the Olympics in London in 2012, which is a massive achievement for a nation that's so small in population. And obviously she'll take that first World Cup win at a home tournament last year with her as well. So, yeah, she's had a remarkable career with some real high points to take with her.
Absolutely, she has. We wish her all the very best. Right, it's been a pleasure. I wish you the very best tonight, Emma, for Republic of Ireland. Not too much, obviously. As England fan in me is desperate to get out of this group of death. But it's been lovely having you on. Take care.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Wonderful debut from you as well, Amy Rushkey. See you soon.
See you soon. Enjoy Dublin.
Susie, I'm very much looking forward to our touristy afternoon. I'll see you later.
See you later.
Okay, keep having your say by sending in your questions via X or emailing us at womensfootballweekly@theguardian.com. And as ever, a reminder to sign up to our bi-weekly women's football newsletter. All you need to do is search Moving the Goalposts, sign up. In Tuesday's edition, Louise Taylor looks at War Bella, a play of the incredible story of heroic female footballers during World War One. Then on Thursday, Sophie Downey's going to look at the lost World Cup of 1971, around which the latest documentary, Copper 71, has been made. Looking forward to that. The Guardian Women's Football Weekly is produced by Sophie Downey and Silas Gray. Music composition was by Laura Iredale. Our executive producer is Sal Ahmad. Women's Football Weekly is supported by Google Pixel, the only phone engineered by Google and official mobile phone of Arsenal Football Club, Liverpool Football Club and the England teams. Engineered by Google, the Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro are fast and secure with the most advanced Pixel cameras yet. And Google AI powers amazing features for photos and video so you can get even closer to the game. Search Google Store to find out more.
This is The Guardian.